Hi, the Black Talk Media Project would like to invite you to become a member of the BTR Community subscription-based social media platform. BTR Community is a platform that was set up for the listening audience of Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent Black radio network online. For just $24 per year, your subscription gives you access to an interactive space to share information with like-minded people with your privacy guaranteed. Your subscription will go a long way to help us maintain and improve our current media platforms. It will also help provide a budget so that we can begin the task of establishing localized media centers and radio stations across the United States. The best way to show your support and appreciation for what we do here at Black Talk Radio is to subscribe. Help us to help you be informed. Join BTRCommunity.com today.
The views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Dinar would have had serious consequences for the world financial system, but may also have empowered the people of Africa, something black activists say the US wants to avoid at all costs.
We're slicing cake. We're slicing cake. We're slicing cake.
Say the US wants to avoid at all costs.
We're slicing cake.
Say the US wants to avoid at all costs. Gaddafi didn't give up. In the months leading up to the military intervention, he called on African and Muslim nations to join together to create this new currency that would rival the dollar and euro. They would sell oil and other resources around the world only for gold dinars. It's an idea that would shift the economic balance of the world. Countries' wealth would depend on how much gold they have, not how many dollars they trade. And Libya has 144 tons of gold.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Tando Radio Show. Today is May the 22nd, 2018. Dave had some unexpected occurrences, and hopefully we will provide some constructive information for you tonight. Brother Roz, are you there?
Yes, greetings, peace and love to you. Yes, I'm here. I've had to take care of some last minute things, that's all, my bad.
All right, just before we get started, we'd like to take care of a few small things. If you receive anything good out of this station, which I have in the past and currently, and all of you who tune in on a regular basis, by all means, give some of your financial equity to BTR Community. You can join BTR Community for $24 a year, and just to help Brother Scotty continue to provide this wonderful platform that we all get to enjoy on a daily basis. So, Brother Roz, would you like to go ahead and get into this, to the news today, let the people know what tonight's show will be about?
Yes, my system is just moving a little slow, so I'm just waiting for it to catch up. If you want to start for me, you can. And once I get everything settled, then I'll jump in too. It just seems to be moving a little slow.
Well, tonight we will be getting in. There was a few things that done happened. One of the things we're going to get into is the land grab that's going on, which is actually happening from the inside by the Geechee tribe down in Florida. Is it in Florida? Is it in the Carolina Islands?
Yes, the Carolinas along the coast, Carolinas. Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so what's happening there is that these are These were enslaved Africans brought from the continent, and they just worked themselves after the 13th Amendment supposedly freed the slaves. They was in the islands where nobody was bothering them.
Right.
They was in there.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, brother.
Oh, no. I was just saying they maintained their culture. They continued to grow the same crops that their enslaved ancestors grew. And a lot of those enslaved ancestors ended up buying the land. And they had basically pacts that they made between all of the family groups. And it controlled large acreage, tons and tons of acres worth of land. And all of the different family members basically had a stake in that land. And what is happening now, because of the way that I'm assuming it's a trust, but the way that the legalities of this trust was set up is as such, so that if one person, for any reason, chooses to sell their property, it forces everybody else to have to sell their property. So if one person, let's say, has 15, 20 acres, and that's what they've been allotted per this trust that goes back way more than five generations from what we'll hear about later, and that person wants to sell their 15 or 20 acres, then they're forcing all the other people, and let's say cumulatively they might have 500 acres. So all 500 acres now has to be sold because one person chooses to sell it. And, you know, we're going to find out more about that and how that's working, because a lot of it just has to do with people not valuing the land. And also, I think the ancestors did not think, just based on the circumstances and the history of how they were enslaved and then obtained this land, they did not think that their descendants would actually get rid of the land, which is what's happening in some of these cases. They're being, they're basically facilitating what they're calling business, but in reality they're not taking the other families into consideration. And I think this is something we need to look at, just based on some of the things we've discussed as far as us collectively dealing with land and owning land or controlling land and working together to form communities of our own and control politics in whatever region that we get together to do that in. We have to take these things into consideration, because all it takes is for one person not to have the same understanding and vision as everyone else, and there goes everything. As we'll find out what happened with the descendants of the Geechee people, and we'll hear from Queen Kwet, who is probably the most well known of them, because she's the keeper of the history, and we'll hear about that later. But yeah, that's one of the things we'll be talking about. We're also going to deal with Rakim Balogun, who is the first documented black identity extremist that was arrested by the FBI and went against them in court and won his freedom. Thankfully, he's no longer on the plantation, so we'll talk about that, because there's a really phenomenal video interview. It's like an hour and change, almost 2 hours, so we're not going to play any clips from it, but I did watch it, and it's just powerful to hear this black male who loves his people and who's doing the work in his neighborhood, and what collectively the system did to try and thwart what he was doing, and his powerful response to that, because they asked him some questions in the interview that just turned out to be quite profound. And to hear this black man just stand, you know, perpendicular on his square as like Neta Ta, who's known as the immovable mover. So he's immovable in his stance against the system and movable in regards to helping his people. So powerful. But go ahead, Jenna.
Oh no, I just Scotty reminded me. Today's show, before Dave had to before Dave had to go, it was cheap, easy ways to prepare for the unknown.
Mm.
And one of the articles that he had in there comes from Mid-East Soccer. The battle for Iran nuclear deal: China approaches a watershed. In the other article, because I didn't read that first article, but the other article came from Rise Earth. 12 plants Native Americans use to cure everything. So let's go through that for a second, though, because that caught my eye earlier.
Yeah, it's a good one. I got to check it out earlier. Go ahead.
Now, this was written by Health Cures. That's what it's giving me. The Native American tribe Cherokee is indigenous to the southeastern United States. The tribe believed that they have been given a gift by the Creator, which enabled them to understand and use medicinal herbs. They believed and used the benefits of nature's pharmacy. Moreover, as plants can become scarce over time, they had a unique gathering method, and they picked every third plant they found and thus made sure they would leave sufficient to continue to propagate. However, the following 12 plants were used by this tribe in the treatment of almost every single illness and health condition. However, before we explain their properties, we must warn you that they can be quite strong and dangerous if not used properly. Keep in mind the Cherokee healers were experienced as they had centuries of practice. Furthermore, it is of high importance to understand their value as powerful natural medicines, so you should be gentle when scavenging them. These are the natural plants that provide amazing health benefits. The Big Scratch, or wild ginger, says the tribe believed that the mild tea from the root of wild ginger stimulates digestion and treats the upset stomach, colic, and intestinal gas. Also, the strong tea from the root of wild ginger can eliminate secretions from the lungs. Now, I did not know that.
Yeah, I remember I told you that it could actually stop your mucus production if you're sick and you get enough ginger in your system. You'll notice that your nose will stop running, all your mucus will stop running. And it's something I've personally experienced. So, yeah, it's powerful. And also, ginger also.
Hold on, Ross. Let me finish through this 12. Another Native American tribe, the Muskewa, I know I'm butchering that word, cured earaches by using crushed steep stems of wild ginger. The rootstock can replace regular ginger and flowers as flavoring for numerous recipes you prepare. Now, before we go to this next one, would you like to elaborate on that ginger?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry for interjecting, too. I just want to say that ginger actually works better than the pills that they give you for seasickness. They found that ginger works better than that as far as helping seasickness as well. So that's something for people who travel and, you know, or who might be on a boat. They might like to fish but don't like to deal with the byproducts, which can sometimes be seasickness. You want to have a few cups of ginger tea before you hit the open water. And it should basically keep that from happening to you. That's all. My bad.
All right. Well, this is what I'm going to do. This is up in Dave's thread. So I'm going to just read these off real quick. You have hummingbird blossom, which is buckbrush. It says pull out a sticker, which is green bar. Mint, blackberry. Cattail, sumac. I can't pronounce the quailuga. I think that's how you say that. And quailuga. Sumac.
Yeah, sumac.
Quailuga. Okay.
That's a tree.
Just do a wild rose, mullein, yellow dock, squirrel tail, yarrow.
Yeah, yarrow. Mm-hmm.
I've never. You know about all of these herbs, Ross?
I got essential oils for a good few of these that you done mentioned, so I'm familiar with these names too because I have quite a few herbal texts that deal with natural healing, and a lot of these herbs are what's utilized. There's a great book called Basic Herbs for Health and Healing by Brother Hakim, and he basically has different native plants to this land as well as African plants that are now grown in the Western Hemisphere that you can use for natural healing. And a lot of these herbs, if not all of them, are all in that text. So yeah, I'm very familiar with these names.
Now, are these the kind of herbs that grow and people cut them up thinking that they're weeds? Kind of like...
Oh, yeah. I know cattail. Cattail is one that I've seen growing even in Jersey in certain marshy areas when I'm traveling on a train going to and from work. And I know at times the transit authority will cut these bushes down. But I've seen cattail. I've seen nature shows on cattail. And there's a myriad of different things you can use it for. So, yeah, some of these things are literally grow all around us. Blackberries I've seen growing wild in Jersey as well, New York City. So they're there. It's just you have to know what you're looking for. I've even seen Callaloo, which is a plant we use in the Caribbean. I don't hear many people in the States use it, but I'm pretty sure down south they probably do. But Callaloo is in the spinach family, and I've seen it growing literally on the streets in Jersey City. And one of my good friends actually took a plant, a Callaloo plant, that he found growing in his neighbor's yard and actually started growing some in his yard. And he's harvested that for years. So, yeah, there's a lot of different plants that literally grow on the street, you know, right on the side of the road. You wouldn't know that they're actually edible, but they are.
Man, that's amazing. That's amazing. Because I know I have some just right on the side of my house. I had to cut it every time I cut grass. I can't remember what you call it. Poke salad.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Grow right on the side of my house every time.
Dandelions. The other one, the one that grows, I've talked about it before. It's basically considered to be as strong as opium, but non-narcotic. I've actually seen that plant in my own yard, and it has this milky substance that comes out of it. And it's really bitter, but it's exceptional for pain killing. Oh my gosh. I'm trying to remember it now.
Wild lettuce.
That's it. Wild lettuce. Yes, that's the one. And that is one powerful one. And I've actually used the tea for that, and it's helped me quite a bit in the past. But thankfully, I haven't needed it recently. But yes, that's the one, wild lettuce. Thank you very much for remembering that for me. Having a brain
no
fart
worries,
at the moment.
No worries. And as you stated, that's one of the things that I do with my children. We have two state parks. I'm in the middle of two state parks. We have Booker T. Washington State Park, and we also have Harrison Bay State Park. Interesting story with those two state parks right there, right beside each other. That's for another show. But what I do is I have a few books that recognize different plants. I'm going through, and what I would like to do would be able to have them to point out and know what's poisonous and what is not, you know, as far as if anything happens, any of the stuff that we've been discussing here on Tando and on all of the other shows on Black Talk Radio Network, to be able to point those things out, whether you should or shouldn't touch these things. So that's one of the things that we have on schedule for the summer, is to go through both of these parks where it's still very heavily wooded area and be able to see these things. I'm wondering if I'm going to see some of those same herbs just out there. Go ahead. What were you saying, brother?
Oh, no. I said that's a great thing because, you know, once they become familiar with them, then you can use them. I remember, you know, just being in Trinidad, and if somebody had an illness or got sick or had some stomach problem, you know, my grandmother would describe the plant. If you didn't know it, she knew you didn't know it, send you out in the yard to look for it. You know, she'll tell you how much to pluck from the yard, bring it back, and she'll make some tea, and whatever the ailment was will be taken care of. It was like a regular thing all the time. Fever, like you were saying, colic, all kinds of different things, and there was always herbs, you know, that were always growing within arm's reach of on my grandmother's property in Trinidad, and dang, go outside, get them. You know, she'll do what she has to do, work her magic, put that beautiful feminine essence in it, and once you tried it, you will feel better. You know, so this is stuff I've personally experienced. So it's something that, you know, you do that with your children, you'll be setting them up for life as far as being able to help themselves and help others. Matter of fact, the indigenous people use tobacco in a myriad of ways as far as healing was concerned. One of the main things they would use it for is to disinfect wounds, to instantly stop bleeding, and also to heal a wound without having to use sutures or to sew it up. I remember right. Dr. Van Sertima was talking about, and it's actually when they came before Columbus, that one of the colonizers that came over here, as they were traveling through the thick brush, they were cutting plants with the cutlass, and somehow the guy ended up slicing his arm open, and it was a gaping wound that would normally require stitches. And the native people just came to him. You know, they told him come to wherever they do that work, because it's not in the jungle proper. But they had the tobacco leaves. They got it. They put some of the juice in the wound, and the bleeding stopped. And then they took like two leaves and wrapped it around the entire area of his arm, his forearm that was cut. And within, I think it was like a week to 2 weeks, the wound healed, and there was no mark. It healed as if he never had his arm chopped open. And that was, you know, Dr. Van Sertima has that documented in his book, and he's also, direct descendant and lived with his people, the Makusi Indians in Guyana. So he actually lived in the Amazon, lived with jaguars, lived with all the animals you see on nature programs before he ended up going to first the city in Guyana, and then eventually to the state to complete his education and then do the phenomenal work that he's done for our people. So so he also knows these things from firsthand experience, just from living in the Amazon with his family. So it's powerful stuff, man. And
just to bring it home, I know some of the older listeners probably remember, but I know my grandfather, which it seems strange to me now, but he used to dip, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those things that I'm not sure if the tobacco was stronger or more pure or what have you, but mm-hmm. his dip don't look like the dip I see people dipping nowadays. But if anybody got a cut or anything, like you said, healing wounds, that's what mm-hmm. he would do. He would rinse it off, take that nasty dip out of his mouth, and put it on you.
Well, it
and then
the
wrap
germs,
it up. And I was like, yo, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Say again?
No, I said because the juice in the tobacco leaf kills germs, it wouldn't have been a problem that he chewed it up. It would have actually just facilitated the enzyme. So, you know, you would think, like, why would he, you know, take that out of his mouth? It's probably nasty. Nah, there would be no germs in it because it kills germs so phenomenally.
I mean, it's just one of those things. It's just one of those things that where you're a young child and, you know, one of the first things you learn is not to spit, you know, and mm-hmm. then you see your grandfather go right against that rule, you know, from your perception at that small age, no understanding or none of that. And he just mm-hmm. take this big glob and put it on you. So it's just one of my memories of my grandfather watching him do that to some of my uncles and older cousins and what have you. But continuing on, I like that. I'm gonna have to go a little bit deeper into that article that Dave put up there. Just a few other ways to before we get on into what we was gonna talk about, a mm-hmm. few other ways to prepare cheaply would be, we've talked about knives, we've talked about bow and arrows, crossbows, of course, firearms.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that there's a few things that you have, Brother Rise, that I'd like for you to let the listeners know about. I know me and my son, we go out and we're getting our slingshot aim mm-hmm. up to par. And I know that you practice with that along with a few other things that are not very expensive. Would you expound on that a little bit, please?
Sure. I use different types of slingshots that I have here. I also have throwing knives that I practice with as well. And if you become adept at that, that's a whole nother level of skill that you can apply in an emergency if necessary. I also have a blowgun as well. And that is something you can use to maybe hunt small game, like small birds, or, you know, if you're hunting squirrels or little animals. You can use it for that, depending on the size of the darts that you're using. But see, accuracy is really interesting because you can probably, using the blowgun, you can probably get like over 300 feet per second on that dart. So when it hits whatever it hits, it's with a really powerful impact. So yeah, those are just some of the other things, you know, that you can utilize and also practice with. Just put in a little time. It's a great way to pass the time, but as you practice with it, you become more and more adept. With the throwing knives, I actually had a video of a guy who basically mastered that art, and he was explaining how to do it. And a lot of the misconceptions I had about knife throwing, he completely removed those things. And he was even able in the video to use a toothpick like a dart. And when he threw it at the piece of wood, it went into the wood like if it was steel. And I was just blown away because I had never seen something like he used a toothpick. He used the paperclip.
Anything with a sharp edge.
He straightened out a paperclip. He used that, and it stuck in the piece of wood like a dart. It was crazy, and it was just interesting. So I've been practicing with those with the throwing knives, and they can be quite lethal too. don't think that it's something that doesn't work. Once you know what you're doing, then really sky's the limit. And like the guy showed in the video that I have, just about anything can be a projectile once you know how to throw it. I mean, I haven't gotten to the point where I could throw any of those things that I just described that I saw him do, but with the knives, I'm pretty decent. I'm pretty decent. So yeah, those are just some of the other things you can do. Go ahead.
I noticed you used the term just to pass the time. Well, you know, all of our goals, whether we know it or not, is to be more productive.
Right.
And learning how to do some of those activities. I know I had a ball with my slingshot, putting holes in all kind of plastic cups. I acted too fast because now I got to replace some of those plastic cups, but it's neither here nor there. It's a nice way to just get prepared for whatever may be coming. You know, we have seen the signs, you know, and even a few of the symptoms, you know. so we just have to get prepared for those type of things. And also want to, along with those plants, because I didn't read everything that was in there, I just went over the plants. But when you get into that, you'll find the different uses of those plants. Yeah. So that's one of the important things, that you want to use it for the correct issues and ailments too, or you won't get no treatment, you know. So I think those are very important. Like I said, I'm gonna be on the hunt, taking pictures, identifying what's natural around here, because I am in that area that they speak of, southeastern Tennessee. So
right.
That's great perfect information for not only for all of us, but for me in particular, since I'm down in that space. But let's get into some of these articles that we were going to go over, Brother Riser. You have some of them. Where would you like to go first?
I think I wanted to go into, there's one here that's really short, but it's quite insightful. It's from melanoidnation.org. And it's entitled "Real Life Spook Who Sat by the Door: Black Federal Agent Punished for Exposing FBI Racism." In the late 1960s to early 1970s, there was a controversial novel and movie entitled "The Spook Who Sat by the Door." That was a fictional story of Dan Freeman, the first black CIA officer. The Freeman character was a secret black nationalist who infiltrated the CIA to gather intel. Freeman later used the skills he learned at the Bureau to train black street gangs to wage guerrilla warfare against the CIA. The term quote-unquote spook had a double meaning. Spook is a term used for CIA agents. This is most likely because of their covert maneuvering. The term is also used as a racial epithet for black people. The sat by the door reference, quote-unquote, is based on a practice used by white organizations who hire tokenized black people and place them in office positions at the front desk or by the front door, unquote, of the business. This is a tactic to make the one black person at an organization as visible as possible to give the illusion of racial diversity. The film version of this story was so controversial at the time, the FBI had all the film prints removed from the movie theaters in the 1970s, something I talked about on the last show we did. There was always been a longstanding concern that black people within the ranks of the FBI and CIA and general military and police agencies would utilize their training and knowledge against the system of white supremacy. This week in Minnesota, there was a real-life spook who sat by the door named Terry J. Albury, a 39-year-old black counterterrorism agent for the FBI, who appeared in federal court in St. Paul. Albury was charged on one count of unauthorized disclosure of national defense information and one count of unauthorized retention of national defense information. Albury pled guilty to leaking the classified documents to a reporter, saying in a statement that he knew it was illegal, but he felt he had to act against a culture in the Bureau that often mistreats minority communities with suspicion and disrespect. At the Columbia Journalism Review, Albury's lawyer stated, for Terry, the only African-American field agent in Minneapolis, in the Minneapolis office, the problem of racism both within the FBI and its interactions with minority communities was especially pronounced. The situation became even more acute for him when, having previously served a tour for the FBI in Iraq, he was assigned to the counterterrorism squad and was required firsthand to implement FBI investigation directives that profiled and intimidated minority communities in Minnesota and other locations in which Terry served. So Terry J. Albury is being punished for being a whistleblower against systematic unconstitutional racial injustices within the FBI. Back in 2006, the FBI released documents stating that white supremacist groups had infiltrated law enforcement organizations, yet the FBI never specified what they were going to do to stop or even counter this infiltration. This has led many to believe the FBI itself has been infiltrated by these same white supremacist groups. As we see the number of racialized anti-black executions that are being allowed by race soldiers employed as quote unquote police around the country, and the FBI's complicity in these unconstitutional executions, there may be some merit to these suspicions. That's the end of the article, but I think I brought this up when we did Tando last week, and Scotty was saying it was one of the, at the time he was saying it was one of the great examples of what, you know, fighting the system looks like, and this kind of talks to that, the fact that this brother was able to be in the FBI and then expose what they were doing. It speaks volumes to the power that we have. And obviously in the article, it says that that is a big fear of theirs, that, you know, black people go into these different agencies, learn that information, and take it back to our communities to help our people counter the system of white supremacy. So it is a tangible fear that they are trying to fight. So the psychological indoctrination of black people who decide to work for these organizations, as far as their indoctrination into a system of anti-blackness, is going to be profound. And it says a lot to me that right now they don't really have that kind of a problem at this particular point. From what I know, there aren't many people that are publicly known anyway that are doing anything of that type. The brother Rakim Balogun is one of those people, because he did the same thing with what he learned in the military, which Scotty talked about, Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, who did the same thing. Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, who also did the same thing with the Black Panthers, and there's quite a few others. But it's just it should be a nice little sign for us as far as some of the things we need to get into to protect ourselves and help our people collectively be able to combat our abuse and just the pure terrorism that we face on a regular basis.
Well, you know, that's a great transition, man, because I was going right into him also, because okay. This guy, before we even get into, because I know you wanted to discuss mm-hmm. why they picked him up, mm-hmm. but what's even more exciting is that this brother went in there, and him and his lawyer, they used the system, the actual, you know, they, I think the exact words he used is that they was too broad of a definition. Because yes. he got stopped for they said he wasn't supposed to have a gun.
Right, because
so he used the actual definition of what they charged him with, being black identity extremists, as a way to circumvent staying in prison.
Yeah.
So it's using, because one of the things that I always say is, yeah, we do need to end the system altogether. In the system, but mm-hmm. until we can do that, you have to be able to use the system that's in place the best way that you can. And this right here was a great example of it. Go ahead, Ross.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that, just to clarify from what he had said in regards to how he was supposedly not supposed to have a weapon based and that was supposedly legally based, even though the FBI admitted to him he never committed a crime. But it was what he was doing in the community that made them, you know, bring this frivolous suit to him. Was he had had a argument with a black female, and it was something that had happened at a public event, and he was charged with assault, even though he never actually put his hands on the female. But he did state that the argument got so bad that the way that they used the law in that state, they used the law to say that it was a form of verbal assault, like something like that. They basically were able to charge him with assault, though he didn't actually physically touch the female. They were just arguing. And because he didn't actually commit a crime per se, there was really no reason for them to say he shouldn't have a weapon. He never had a violent crime. He never committed any crime whatsoever. So, yeah, like you said, he was able to successfully use the law against them because of the way that the law was written in that particular state. And he was able to facilitate, you know, getting himself freed from the plantation based on that information. And in the video, which is posted in our thread for today's show, I just implore people to watch it, because you'll learn a ton about how the system is working to attack black people who are doing constructive things in the community. And he told a story about the KKK, or one of those white supremacist groups, was planning to have a rally in his community, and he rounded up all of his people who were trained with trained as far as just knowing how to use weapons, they're trained in hand-to-hand combat, all of that stuff. And they came to meet these white folks, and the white folks got so scared they called the police for an escort, because they were afraid to face these black people with guns, openly carrying these weapons. And he said it was all of about 15 minutes before them and the police packed up and left, because they all felt that intimidated. So that was the kind of force they were met with, the potential that if they tried anything, they were going to get laid down in short order. And that was when, from what I understand, if I remember correctly, that was when things really ratcheted up as far as them looking for a reason to really, really go after him, because they were doing such phenomenal things in the community. And when they saw that stance, it kind of reminds me of Malcolm X, when the scene in the movie where they say no one man should have that much power. It kind of reminded me of that, because they saw what he was doing. They saw that he had the people organized, ready to defend their community. You know, they all had licenses for their weapons, so nobody was running around, you know, without being, you know, properly vetted as far as legally speaking. They all were legally able to carry their firearms, and they were able to meet these white supremacists. And what he said was, we're not going to let these white supremacists come through our community. It's just not happening. So they didn't threaten them or anything. They just, you know, they stood there and they did what they were supposed to do. And both them and the slave catchers went packing. In short order, they were packing quite quickly. So that says a lot in 2017. That you know, you have some black people with that kind of testicular fortitude and love of self and community to make something like that happen in today's day and age. So yeah, go ahead, Dennis.
Well, let me to say that. I got this article from the Garden that kind of clarify, because make a little small correction,
Jerry.
Is that they didn't pick him up for the quote unquote assault. They picked him up for a Facebook post. So
hey,
I got a little article that I want to get
into
hear? Real quick. Yes, Brother Scotty, I hear you. My apologies.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, he was charged with making threats to police officers, even though he didn't make a threat. And that'll come out in the Guardian article. But this is what I wanted to point out, though. And this is not to criticize anything that anybody is doing. But is it constructive for us to form these groups and then make a website for the group and have public demonstrations? It's one thing when you get a call to action because of something is going down, and then, you know, whatever your method of contacting the people who are part of that group to deploy them, you know. But in terms of having a public website, doing public demonstrations to be seen, and putting certain stuff on Facebook when we know everything is being surveilled, is that constructive?
Absolutely.
Is that constructive? Or should we be more clandestine in our activities? That's the question I want to ask.
That's a great question. Go ahead, yeah. Ross.
I just want to answer that because I think Brother Otis said it last time we did Tando last Friday. You know, we can't go out publicly telling our colonizer what we're doing. You know, those conversations should be had off air, and then we just do it. You know, that's how the system works. The system doesn't broadcast what they're doing, and if they do broadcast it, it's already done. Whenever they broadcast it, it's already done. We just don't know it until they broadcast it. But, you know, we have a habit, and even Minister Malcolm used to say that. And funny, because Dave and I talked about this earlier today when, you know, he had called me about doing the show. You know, his mother, I told him, his mother gave him some of the best advice ever. You know, be careful of what you say, for they will know what you think. You know, you have to really, really be careful about what comes out of your mouth. Communication is the most powerful tool we have. And when we're communicating over airways, we're communicating not just to our people, but, you know, like Malcolm would say, the infiltrators are there too. The fifth columnists are there too. And we have to understand that. So we have to really codify. And I think you're absolutely correct that we should not be doing those things publicly. We should only, you know, show any aspects of those parts of ourselves when it's absolutely necessary. And when you do so, it should be in a controlled fashion, and it should be quick and to the point, and then you go back to, you know, that clandestine behavior. We have to function in that manner. Go ahead.
Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't ever do anything publicly, but I'm saying in certain sensitive areas where it's likely that we'll mm-hmm. get slapped with that enemy combatant label.
Absolutely.
You know, but in terms of, like, for example, this radio station or this platform, we need mm-hmm. to have these conversations, and you simply can't hide. I have no illusions yep. that I'm hiding from anyone. Okay.
Absolutely.
But if I'm going to participate in an armed self-defense group, then I feel like that activity don't need to be publicized on Facebook. I don't need to be recruiting people off of Facebook. That's something that should be done face to face, and we should conduct ourselves just like y'all mentioned how they conduct themselves, clandestinely.
Absolutely. I agree.
Well,
with
do you?
Exactly.
I got a quick question because I agree with both of you as far as of course. Codification, like you said, not sharing, not letting nobody know what you think. The best reason to not let nobody know what you think is that way they can't be prepared for you, you know.
Exactly.
So my question is, though, is that do you think it's something, because we used to be at this point, when I was growing up, we didn't tell anybody what we were doing. You know, either you caught me or you didn't. And if you didn't catch me, you would never know any of the stuff that we were doing. So now with this age of social media, and then with all of the outright racism that's being cast, do you think that's one of the reasons why a lot of these groups are just being so public about what they're doing? Excuse me. Because they wanting people to see them?
Yeah, I think it is. I heard Neely Fuller make up a term called show-offism. So, again, mm-hmm. I'm not speaking about this brother, which I have had contact with that group, but okay. I'm just speaking in general terms about what Neely Fuller calls show-offism, is that mm-hmm. we want to show off. We want to talk bad, we want to be bad, you know, we want to look bad, and just, you know, that's not being codified. Again, some things require public demonstrations and what have you, but I'm talking about, we're talking about armed groups, if we're talking about creating an armed self-defense network, then they don't need to know until we deploy. In a real life situation, they shouldn't know about our training right. exercises. They shouldn't know about our meetups and all of that. You know, I don't feel
or
like
the
we
numbers.
Yeah. So yeah, the numbers and all of that, man. We have to be more we had to learn how to move behind enemy lines. And I guess some people don't take that to heart, that we are behind enemy lines. How do you move behind enemy lines?
Well, yeah, because I was going to say, you have to be psychologically comfortable, really, really comfortable with, you know, what you think your position is in this country in order to do things like that, which we know historically have caused people to get killed. The Black Panthers are the greatest example of that, or the Black Liberation Army, you know, and be public about it. So to me, it's a false sense of security. Again, that whole concept that I'm American. You know, I could do what white folks do, and it's okay. But no, you can't do what white folks do, because like you said, we're behind enemy lines. And we are considered an insurgent population, intergenerational prisoners of war.
You know, Malcolm X.
Go ahead.
You mentioned Malcolm X, and I remember he was being interrogated by Mike Wallace. So, and yeah. Those who don't know who Mike Wallace was, he was a longtime reporter working for corporate media. He was on CBS. What was that name of that show? 60 Minutes. And what have you. But I remember him interrogating Malcolm about police violence and what was we doing in our community. And Malcolm was like, you know, we have invisible movements. And he kind of left it at that. So, I mean, you can't be invisible. It's the opposite of an invisible movement. And again, I'm just speaking about certain activity. I'm talking about the people activity area war.
Absolutely. You are correct.
I understand exactly. I think you're absolutely right. Like you said, not a shot at these brothers and sisters that's out there doing things in the community or and what have you. But like you said, you know, they shouldn't know the stuff. When it's time for them to see it, they should have no idea that that's what they about to receive. So I understand exactly what you're saying. Did you want to add something else on to that before? Because I wanted to read a small little excerpt out of this Guardian article, who he did the interview with.
Go ahead. You can read it, and then, you know, we chop it up after you read it.
Yeah, because this is quite a large article, so I'm going to just skip down. And it says that they tried to get him to plead guilty. 97% of federal convictions come via plea deal, quote unquote, not trial. But he refused, fought, and won. He was held without bail for 5 months on a bogus firearm charge that the judge ended up throwing out. He lost his car, his home, his job, and the experience of his newborn daughter's early infancy. Now free and trying to get his legs back underneath him, after an ordeal he should have never been put through, he has a GoFundMe page, and it's actually been on the video. You find out that they canceled it. So obviously, a firearms offense wouldn't make someone a Black identity extremist. Even if it were true, that was just the charge the FBI threw at him while digging for reasons to charge him as a terrorist. Do you want to know what their reason for prosecuting him was as a Black identity extremist? He had made some angry Facebook posts about police following the brutal deaths of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling. His entire arrest and prosecution arose from legally exercising the First and Second Amendment rights granted to him by the U.S. Constitution. At a time when the same Americans who claim to support the civil rights of minorities are championing U.S. intelligence agencies and elevating former FBI directors like Robert Mueller and James Comey to defend rock star celebrities, it is a good reminder that the FBI has always been a depraved, Orwellian institution that targets the nation's most disempowered groups for oppression, and that J. Edgar Hoover legacy lives on uninterrupted. Robert Mueller and James Comey are no friends of the American people, and neither is the FBI. I just wanted to add that in there, because like Scotty was saying, is that they got him for threats, which he just made a Facebook post stating that he was not sorry about some of those officers that had just died. So they had been watching him for quite some time. And like you say, that's one of the that's one of those things that we have to be careful about when we speak.
Let them know what he thinks.
And I think this on real life about people just saying stuff because they think they can say it, even if they don't have no intentions on doing anything. What they saying, just stuff that you say could get you locked up, as we see it took 5 months for this brother to come home.
You know what was a key word that was used? And it was angry. He made an angry post. I was angry about this. I was angry about that. We don't make good decisions when we in our emotions. And we can say things about events that happen, but we should, it's not what you say, but it's how you say it, as the old saying goes. And again, that's why codification is important. I talk about slave catchers publicly and things of that nature, but at the same time, I don't express glee or you know, any kind. I'm happy about this slave catcher losing his life or whatnot. Mm-hmm. You know, I find a codified way to express what I'm feeling.
Absolutely. I tell Jenna that all the time. You can say almost anything you want if you know how to say it. When you don't know how to say it, you can get yourself killed. And that's just the facts. Or jail or anything else. And that is something that takes a lot of deep thought and concentration on. And I've always said this because
discipline.
This is what... Oh, go ahead.
Discipline. Yes. Discipline.
Yes, thanks for the word, discipline. You know, emotions are states of trance. That's why when you get into an emotional state, you can't just flip it off. If you're angry, you're not going to be able to just go from angry to, you know, not angry in a split second. The vibration has to shift. Some of the ways you can shift your vibration is through music. If you're upset and you play positive music, it will shift your vibration. It'll basically raise your vibration. You know, I've used Bob Marley for that. It's one of my favorite artists. It's just deeply spiritual, uplifting, you know, music that I've used many occasions to shift my vibration or just change the whole vibration of my environment. Music is one way. Meditation is another. You know, the quickest way to control the emotions or even thought. You know, they'll say you can't shut down thought, but you can. And that's through the breath. That's what makes meditation so important. These are just some of the things you can apply to shifting your vibration so that you can change that emotional state to something that's constructive and positive. And that's pretty much what I think. Scotty is absolutely correct. You know, we have to be able, and Jenna for that matter, we have to be able to understand that there's certain things you can and can't say and should and shouldn't say.
You know,
and a lot of us misinterpret freedom when you hear people say, I'm free, you know, freedom of speech. Well, freedom of speech, you know, even in traditional society, there's a limit on what's considered free speech. Because if it's something that can be detrimental to the community, like going in a theater and yelling fire, then you don't have the freedom to say that. If you're going, you know, you're going... there's consequences.
You know,
and some of these things speaking, can be life-threatening consequences. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Speaking of consequences, you know, study the speech of Malcolm X. Now, he was known as one of the most outspoken, you know, people during his time. But it's not so much what he was saying, it was how he was saying it. He always stressed self-defense. Not once was this man ever arrested for making threats, although he made threats, you know, but he made those threats indirectly in the way that he framed it. It was nothing they could charge him with. Now, obviously, they can make up charges on you. So I don't want to have any illusion that they don't lie and make up stuff and you know, apply false charges to us. But I'd rather it be that rather than I slipped up and said something I should not have said, or said it in a way that was not conducive. Because even if you beat the charges like this brother did, he absolutely did not make an implicit threat against the police. But look at all that he lost and all that it cost him, even though it didn't cost him long-term, you know, because he spent some time in incarcerated, but it didn't, you know, thankfully it didn't cost him years of incarceration, but it cost him in other ways that he needed to start a fundraiser, you know what I'm saying, which got shut down. So is it worth it sometimes to blast, you know, certain people in this society, especially when we're talking about people with a protected status like slave catchers?
Yeah, and it's funny that you said that, because in the video that I posted, which is an interview with Cynetta, you know, Cynetta asked him, well, now that you've gone through all of this stuff with the, you know, the FBI and all of the stuff that's happened to you, are you going to kind of, you know, tone it down a little bit and kind of, you know, kind of ease that? And he was like, no, I think we need to ratchet it up. And I was just like, wow. So, I mean, like, it seems I won't say I'm correct about this, but it seems like he's the type that's ready to lay his life down, because ultimately when you take that stance publicly, then they will show you better than I can tell you. And he said it, and he said it, Cynetta said it to him. He said, you know, you're going to be watched even more now, you know, now that this has happened to you, they're going to be looking for a way to, you know, to lock you back up or whatever, just due to the fact that you did get away, and they really tried hard to get you. So, and his response was, you know, he thinks that he should ratchet up, you know, this activity. And that, to me, when you say something like that publicly, you're drawing a line in the sand, and things may not always end well when, you know, you do those sorts of things. So I hope that nothing crazy happens, or that they don't get the opportunity to, you know, arrest him again. But ultimately, the truth is, you know, that public stance, you want to be codified, like you just said. There should be a code to what you say and what you allow yourself to say publicly. When you're, you know, one-on-one with somebody, you know, that's a different story. And even with that, you know, get your cell phones out the room. You know, my family does that all the time. We don't talk around our cell phones because, you know, our cell phones are listening to us. And, you know, we've seen things and even read about them too, but, you know, where you'll be having a conversation around your phone, you know, didn't go into Google to search for that item or anything. You might just be discussing it around your phone. And then all of a sudden you go to do a search or go on a site that has advertisement, and the very stuff that you were discussing, you find ads for those things. And you know you didn't do a search for them. You didn't do anything online in regards to that. You just had a verbal discussion, and all of a sudden these ads start showing up based on your verbal discussion. So your phone is listening to you. And, you know, these are things we have to take into account. There's extreme codification, and that's how my entire family functions. And I just implore people to do the same for themselves, because your phone is listening to you, and you never know who's on the other end. You know, make sure all of your cameras are covered. We cover ours with electrical tape. You know, the computer cameras covered, both cell phone cameras are covered, all of that, all the time. That's how we roll, you know. And I just say, I mean, even Mark Zuckerberg, there was an article that I posted like last year, where it showed him, and in the background was his computer on the table, and he had tape across the camera. And then the article was about that, like codifying your behavior when it comes to protecting your privacy. So it's just something, you know, that you really want to take into serious consideration, because you really just never know. And the truth is that, you know, we're all being listened to, and it's nothing that any of us can really avoid. It's the way things are. And if you're a melanated person, you're going to really be, you know, monitored, because, like I said, we're considered an insurgent population, you know, that we really are, and we're treated as such. And the story of this brother, Rakim Balogun, is a great story that would kind of outline that, in my opinion.
No, excuse me. I agree with you both. But right now, we're right here at the top of the hour. You are listening to Tando Radio Show with your two guests, me, myself, and Brother Roz. And after we come back from the break, I think make sure that's the right video, Roz.
Yeah, I'm checking it right now.
The video you want to get into. If you have a question or comment about any of the articles or the topics that we're going over right now, by all means, give us a call. That number is 866-510-9025. And that's the international number. My apologies. The other number,
702-804-5056. Again, that's 702-804-5056.
That's not correct, Ross.
Ask a question or comment.
Yeah, 704-802-5056.
Oh, I had it back to front. Thank you, my bad. 704-802-5056. Again, I'm sorry. That's 704-802-5056. And press ** if you wish to ask a question or make a comment. I'm sorry about that.
Thank you.
Make Black Talk Radio your choice for digital black radio. New black media for the new millennium.
Hey, Brother Scott, it's Ross just put a video up in that he wanted to get into at the top of the hour. You see that, sir?
Yes, I got
it pulled
up. Waiting on this ad so I can skip this ad. Okay, here we go.
No worries.
Like thank you.
I always feel my ancestors out in this field with me. I still can hear songs like Stay in the Field, oh, stay in the field, stay in the field until the war has ended.
On a quiet chain of islands off the South Carolina and Georgia coast, is an almost forgotten community called the Gullah or Geechee people. More than anywhere else in America, they've held on to traditions their ancestors brought from Africa. They've stayed on the isolated former plantation land where those ancestors were once enslaved, and developed a culture and language known as Gullah.
It seems pretty isolated back here.
Oh, see, now that's what we call insulated. Yeah, so we insulated. Feel like we're insulated and kind of kept warm and keep our culture alive away from the mainland culture. So sure, if you went just across a couple bridges and you ended up on the mainland, you'll hear people speaking like this. And then you come across onto these 100 Yeti people that crack your teeth like this all day long and things like that. And they say, huh?
Marquetta Goodwine, also known as Queen Quet, still lives on the land where her great-great-grandfather was enslaved 5 generations ago.
We have okra, we plant peanuts, cantaloupe, watermelon, the same things that my great-great-grandfather planted here. And he was the person that actually obtained this land in 1862. So my family has continuously owned it legally since then, but he was actually enslaved here.
Hundreds of plantations ran down the South Carolina and Georgia coast in an area known as the Sea Islands. After the Civil War broke out, the islands were abandoned by the plantation owners, and thousands of people were eventually able to buy the land they were once enslaved on. But today, the landscape is changing.
Folks come in with bulldozers, and the first thing we see is they want to dig up what we've already had for all these generations, and then they want to build something that's antithetical to our culture.
Golf courses, resorts, and condos have replaced Gullah communities. Hilton Head Island was the first to be developed. Once home to about 300 Gullah families, the 42-square-mile island is now home to 26 golf courses, brings in 2 million tourists a year, and is considered one of the top vacation destinations in the United States. Gullah burial grounds dating back to the days of slavery are now the backyards of million-dollar condos in opulent gated communities that new locals fondly call plantations. That development boom is slowly spreading to other areas nearby.
You can hear right now construction in the distance,
yep.
Something else being built.
Yep. One of the things that you'll notice that you'll never see outside of Gullah Geechee homes usually are signs like that. No trespassing.
Well, that's part of the interesting thing is that the land that the Gullah Geechees own, it's all communally owned.
Absolutely, yeah. Most people live on what is in the law called heirs property. And that's because our ancestors, during the U.S. Civil War now, bought property. And so Gullah Geechees became the first group of people of African descent in North America to own land en masse.
Gullah landowners sought to own the land communally among their extended family. Over generations, this communally owned land was passed down to hundreds of heirs, often without legal documents like wills or clear titles. An informal shared ownership system developed, which came to be known as heirs' property. Until recently, heirs' property arrangements kept family properties from being sold because families depended on the land and each other. But today, developers are using legal loopholes to acquire heirs' property, sometimes for pennies on the dollar, whether the people living there want to sell or not. We visited Willie Hayward, a local attorney who helps Gullah families protect their property.
When the ancestors acquired it, this was not a very desirable place to live because of the lack of air conditioning, mosquitoes, alligators, and lack of access, lack of bridges and so on and so forth, and roads. But now that it's changed, so that progress, for lack of a better word, has brought in folks who now want to divest Gullah Geechee people of that land for development purposes.
What's the extent of the threat right now to the actual land? I mean, how much land are we talking about having been lost in the past few years?
Areas that I see that, in my opinion, that were 90% above Gullah Geechee folks that are now less than 10, if that.
One of the interesting things that we picked up on is that, you know, just one owner who owns one small part of it can kind of force the entire thing to be sold. How does that even work?
The law allows that. It allows just simply, all you have to do is allege that you have an interest. That interest may be 0.01%.
Heirs' properties are divided into shares, with each family member holding a certain portion of ownership. The law allows anyone owning part of an heir's property to force the other owners to sell the entire property by going to a judge and asking for their dollar value of their share. Technically, other heirs who want to keep the land could buy out their share. But in reality, few have the means to purchase that share on the open market. It's just too expensive. And because there are so many owners, the land often can't be subdivided. The only practical solution is to sell the land at a court auction or just go along with development.
What's unique about the Gullah Geechee people, we have more heirs outside of South Carolina. In many cases, these heirs have lost contact with South Carolina, never been to South Carolina, don't know anything about South Carolina. But legally, they have an interest in that property.
In the end, Gullah people are forced off the land they own to make way for resort communities they can't afford to live in. Adolph Brown is a real estate broker on Hilton Head Island.
Here's a piece right now. As you see, there's a for sale sign. Yeah. This is all theirs. You can almost tell it by the mobile homes. Like you'll see, a bunch of mobile homes, together. That's a good indication that you're on a tract of land that's heirs' property.
He showed us a piece of heirs' property he's planning to develop. Some distant relatives who live out of state recently decided they wanted to work with Adolph to develop the land, forcing the sale of the entire property and displacing relatives who live there.
Some of the people don't want to sell, obviously, because they've lived here their whole lives. You can see there's a lot of mobile homes. So there are 19 in total that, there's going to be an issue with. And so, what do we do? What do they do?
Their only option would be to buy those relatives out. But they don't have the means to do so. Waterfront property here can go for $800,000 an acre. Adolph moved to Hilton Head from New York 10 years ago when he discovered he owned shares of an heir's property. Some of the work you've done, it's kind of got you a bad rep on the island right now, yeah?
Yeah, it has. It has. A lot of the islanders think I'm the bad guy, I'm the city slicker bamboozler dude, you know what I mean?
People here feel like their entire culture is being sold along with this property. That the Gullah culture is basically fading away as more developers buy up these lands through heirs' property.
Right.
I mean, do you understand that anger?
I understand the anger, and I understand the Gullah culture. My grandmother was a midwife on Hilton Head, so almost every African American that was born from in the 60s, 50s, 40s, she brought them into the world. The problem comes in when the world changes. Well, my family doesn't barter with food. They go to regular jobs and have 9-to-5s and have gone to college and they work Fortune 500 companies now.
So it's kind of, I mean, you can see the division. Like, I'm sure there are people who think of this as like a boon, just like they won the lottery almost. And there's others who think of it as, I'm losing my way of life, I'm losing my home.
Right,
I'm losing. And trying to rectify those two situations. I mean, what solution can you come up with?
The only solution I've ever seen is to develop it. And I give people this analogy of the American Indians that were, you know, downtown Wall Street. They had the teepees there, they had the little communities. Could you imagine today there being 20 acres that's Indian reserve in Wall Street?
Yeah, but that
can't happen.
That was hundreds of years ago.
What I'm saying is either you have to be progressive or you will get run over, taxed out, moved out. Eventually it will happen.
Up the coast, the once quiet community of Mount Pleasant recently became the 9th fastest growing city in the country. The Phillips community, settled by former slaves of the Phillips Plantation, is one of two Gullah communities left there. So we're in Phillips community right now, which is a Gullah community right outside of Charleston. And this kind of used to be a really isolated area. But now, basically, what you have is all these developments that have sprung up around it. So it's kind of like a donut hole. So it's only really a question of time, how much longer the people here can hold out before they're either priced out or their homes are bought out from underneath them. Lawrence Palmer has spent his whole life here.
When I was growing up, it was a close-knit community. If someone got a house to be built, everybody joined in and helped that person build that house. Don't have to pay a dime. When time to come around to you, the community get together and do the same thing to you.
And now it seems like a lot of people are trying to get this property right here.
Oh, yeah. They are moving in very swiftly.
And are people trying to actively get your land right now? Are they trying to buy your lands?
Oh, yeah. They tried to buy my property several times. But I told them, no, it's not for sale. When I should die, I hope that some of the family member would step up and try to keep it for the future generation. This community was one big family. But now the community is far divided. Everybody is more like an individual. Number one, looking out for number one. The heck was the rest.
As the push to sell keeps on building, the Gullah are running out of options.
If we look at the situation on the Fusty Island right now, a lot of the native people are gone. The few pockets of Gullah Geechee on St. Simon is drying up like the water of California today. It's all but non-existent. How can we stop this?
We don't really have a community, or I guess we have maybe a few neighborhoods, but not a real community, and I think we need to develop them. And that's one way to stop people from encroaching on your land.
We need to meet with each other. We want to meet right after the funeral, when emotions are out of control.
There's a serious erosion of trust, too, within the black community. Mm-hmm. Without trust, we definitely can't be unified.
I mean, in my family, we lost a lot of land. But the thing of it is like I started something new. I started buying land, and I wanted, because I know the importance of land, and I want to keep it in the family. I want to keep it going.
This is something that we all need to take with us and to explore ways in which we can do that. And one of the ways that we may have to do this is the African spirit. And let's see whether or not the African spirit can come and bring some knowledge or wisdom into this problem that we are having as a culture and as a people.
In addition to these community meetings, the Gullah turn to traditions rooted in those their ancestors brought here more than 200 years ago.
Most gracious, most merciful. We give thanks and praises to God Almighty, Lord of all the worlds, Master of the Day of Judgment. Thee do we worship, and thy aid we deceit. Show we the straight way, the way of those in the go astray. Amen.
In some respects, it's a gentrification story. One group pushed out by a wealthier one. But given the land and people involved, a piece of American history is being lost. And when it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah, we got that video if you would like to look at it, because it's the visuals in that are pretty important too. It's a beautiful place, but we got into this because I asked a question on Melanated Roots a few weeks back. Is there a code that we all should have as melanated people, regardless of what you do specifically in your home? Shouldn't there be a code that we have on how to deal with each other? Now, of course, you're going to tweak your own specifically, but just when we out in public, whether we're talking about in life, face to face, or via social media, or however you contacting people, Skype or what have you, just a general code of conduct that we use when addressing each other. I'm going to just post that question to the family. I'm going to post that question to the family and see if y'all have any, what's y'all thoughts? But the reason I asked that question is because when we come together, like they was just saying, we all come together and say we purchase 500 acres of land. I can't even get the words out. This is a good example. That's what I'm trying to say. My apologies. This is a great example of what can happen if you're not paying attention to how things are structured. But I see we have Brother Rio coming in. How you doing tonight, Brother Rio?
Hey, Brother Rio.
Hey, Brother. Hey, Brother Rob.
Hey, I'm still learning.
Great.
How are you?
And that was...
You're breaking up a little bit.
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Brother Rio, if you can call us from your phone, we're not able to hear you and it's breaking up a lot.
Yeah, it seems to be going in like every split second, chopping
in. I'm kind of confused
about
something.
What were you going to say, Rob? Say again, Scotty.
Yeah, years ago, it might have been like, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I did a series of interviews with the Gullah Geechee. I forget the guy's name. Forgive me. I think his name was Jeff. But they live on the Sapelo Islands of Georgia. And he was talking about family land trust, and he actually started an organization that goes around two communities that's being gentrified, now that I recall some of our conversations, to show them legal strategies of creating community land trust and what have you, to prevent this. Now, that's on Sapelo Island, which is off the coast of Georgia. But when I first started interviewing him, he was talking about the dirty stuff the state was doing in terms of, like, one of the dirty tricks they'll do is, like, raise the property taxes so high that you can't afford it every year. You know what I'm saying? And then if you can't afford the property taxes, then they will auction off your land if you don't pay the taxes. So he was talking about, you know, family land trust, which I've heard, you know, other people talk about on different programs that I have listened to. But now I also get a better understanding. And I was just talking to one of my elder cousins last week, because we got a cousin that sounds just like that dude who was making excuses for his greed. I'm sorry.
What he said he want to sell everything.
It's not that he want to sell everything. It's he want to sell off pieces that he ain't got no right to sell off. And then they use fraud to do it. Like one of my great aunt's husband, who had married into the family, was selling these white people tracts of land that he ain't had no right to sell them. And these were fraudulent deeds. And this is the stuff that we're talking about getting back. But I do understand, one of my elder cousins said that although this is community property, we had to split it up into individual tracts with different family members. Let's say like my uncle got a tract, another uncle got a tract, an aunt got a tract, and so on and so on to my second and third cousins, because we're all still here and been here for hundreds of years as a family, a community. But he was saying that it'd have been easier for them to steal the land if we didn't split it up into individual tracts. But we have this verbal understanding that all of it belongs to us as a family and not as individual. But it's nothing to stop somebody from selling off their individual tract if they want to. And it's just one great big piece of land that, you know, everybody, you know, pretty much owns. It's tricky, man. It's very tricky.
Yeah. And people have to really be of one accord in that regard to own it all together. And that's where, like, when I say the prayer, you know, I'm in the love of the all, I can, you know, succeed as a part of the all and fail as an individual. That's where that comes from. Like, you're looking at all of you all thinking of the collective first. And that's the way that, you know, we do as traditional people. The group comes before the individual. And, you know, this society, the individual comes before everybody. It's, you know, screw you, gimme, 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 like Tupac said. And that's really how we're raised to think and function. And when you hear the guy who's I think it was his grandmother or great grandmother who was the midwife, and you hear him, you know, he's talking about, I talk to them about change, and I use the Native Americans as his example and all of this craziness. Is just really, and like they said earlier in the video, is people who own plots of land down there who have no connection to the land, never been to South Carolina, really don't care to go to South Carolina, and in some cases, those are the people who want to sell. So they're like, I don't want that, you know. I live in the city. Yeah. I don't want nothing to do with that nonsense. I'm up here, you know, and that's the mentality. So,
but I can get some money though.
Exactly, I can get a piece and take, you know, take the debt note and try to make what I think is a better life for me and my family off of these debt notes. And this all ties into. Let us know your name, where you're calling from, and your question or comment.
We got two.
Is that Rio?
Go ahead, Brother Jared. I can wait my turn. Go ahead.
You go ahead, because we got area code 717 up after you. We'll get with you in just a moment. I was trying to let Roz finish his thought first, though. But go ahead.
Okay, well,
Brother Rio.
You know, I was echoing those sentiments. I was going to say exactly what Brother Roz said, and I can remember, you know, I had a sudden feeling of sadness when I heard, you know, that brother saying that, because he has lost his connection to that land. And, you know, he was talking about being progressive, and all I heard was being brainwashed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody moved out, they went on to college, now they're working for Fortune 500 companies, and as you said, Brother Jerry, you know, they're just looking for that, for those Federal Reserve notes to
Brother Rio,
what they perceive as life, and they've lost that connection to their past, their history, and the importance of that land. And that is just truly saddening. Yes, sir.
With just to give you a little clarification, this guy is helping. He never lived on that land. You know, he found out that he had some land down there, and he moved there. See, what he is he's a real estate agent trying to sell the land of his ancestors. I just wanted to give that clarification to you.
Right, but I'm also speaking to that disconnect, because he didn't know he had land there. So that means somewhere along his family tree, they didn't pass on those stories or that history that's a part of his family. I mean, he found out that, you know, his grandmother delivered, 30 years of people in that area? And she knows each and every one of them. She brought them into the world. He had no knowledge of that history until he found out, hey, I got some land down there, and, you know, this is how I'm tied to the land. He didn't know that until then. I mean, that is a disconnect, and that's very saddening, and I think that is illustrative of what the majority of us being melanated people in this country are going through or went through, and it was easy to sell off land.
I agree.
Think that's how thorough the brainwashing is. You know, when I tell that story, the African proverb of the lion and the wild boar, and, you know, they kidnap that baby, that lion cub, and raise the lion cub to think it's a boar. And it eats grass like the boars, and it hangs out with the boars, and it protects them from other lions by letting them know, you know, being a lookout, you know, and telling them, hey, the lions are coming, let's go hide. And then eventually, the boars, you know, at one time the lions attack, and they're unprepared for it, and they eventually lock out this lion cub, and he's now left to terrified, looking at other lions. And they laugh at him, thinking like he's playing, but he really is indoctrinated to think like the people who raised him. And to me, this guy's a great example of when you are so immersed in the culture that has been set forth, the matrix that has been set forth by the colonizer. That's the mentality you have. How can I sell it? How can I build on it? You know, you heard them saying there's golf properties popping up everywhere and $1 million homes. And they're pricing out, you know, the native people that's been there for generations. As a collective, they were all on the same page. And like he said, you know, our relatives don't barter food and stuff. We work at Fortune 500 companies. So they're doing it the way that we've been doing it. You know, they're bartering, they're trading, they're, you know, helping each other out. One brother was saying that, you know, when one person is building a house, everybody builds a house together. And then if somebody else asks, and you don't have to pay them or anything. And I remember in Trinidad, that's how a lot of my relatives' houses were built, you know? So it's a powerful thing when you have a collective of people who are all on the same page and they're about the community. That is the intergenerational beauty of what they had. And now you have literally, and there's another African proverb, when you don't have enemies within, enemies without can do very little harm. And that brother is the enemy within. The genetically related to you enemy within, who's willing to just sell off everything and not even care that he's displacing his other relatives. It's all about what he wants. It's the individual screwing the all and just saying, forget y'all, this is about what I want. Y'all are backwards. You know, if they're going to develop this land anyway, they're going to take it, so let's just give it to them now and call it a day. And that's the mentality that we're combating. That's what we have to combat as far as the way that we see the world and understand the world. And the importance of land. You know, when my grandfather passed away, a lot of what my mother would have inherited was taken from her, and a lot of it was land, because my grandfather did actually buy quite a bit of land, and he owned a few businesses, and she got basically nothing from that, and that's what facilitated her moving to America. She was like, hey, that's his stuff, I need to go get my own. And her and my father decided they were going to leave Trinidad and come here, and that's what they did. So, you know, you'd be surprised. Like, and sometimes I hear some of my elders, well, a lot of them have passed away now, but when they used to talk about this stuff, and I would hear my mom sometimes talk about it, and you could hear that it was disturbing for her to not have that land in the land of her birth that her father left for her, that should have been hers, but was, you know, basically housed by different aunts and uncles. So, yeah, there is something about that land, and you got to have that connection to it. It's just, there's an intimate bond with it, you know, and when you lose that, it's like losing everything, because the land is basically everything. It's what sustains us, you know. So it's deep. It's really deep.
I'm looking for something similar to that right now myself. While I'm doing the history of my family, I find that my grandfather, like five times removed, he owned a farm right there in South Carolina. Well, South Carolina and Georgia, I believe it's Stevenson County. If you're familiar with that, I don't know if that's the right county or not, but I'm believing so. But his farm went from him employing some of my great uncles and what have you to being non-existent. So it's a constant land grab. But we are here at the bottom of the hour. You are listening to Tando Radio with your guest hosts, Roz and Jenna. We'll be right back in just a few. We'll get to the next call as soon as we come back from the break.
Yes, sir.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Question or comment, by all means, give us a call. That number is 704-802-5056. Press ** to put yourself in the queue, and we'll get with you as soon as possible. Sorry for your wait. Please let us know your name and where you're calling from.
It's always good to hear the voice of a friend.
Brother Davis. How are you?
It's always good, brothers. I'm going to tell you, this show is fantastic. You know, it's interesting how great minds think alike, because literally, last week I did a show on the Tavistock Institute, and literally they utilize a lot of these principles that you're talking about today that have allowed black people to give away their greatest value. And the sad part about it is because they have been initiated to learn under a system that taught them value. Now, the reason why I say that is because in both cases, a lot of black people don't even know what they would want to do if they get a large sum of money. You know, they think about what they could buy, but they don't think about the principle about what they can do, not only for themselves, but they're for generations to come. And the sad part about it, a lot of that has to do with the way we were taught value. You see, we were taught value through a dollar sign. The sad part about it is the true value, the precious value that we were taught previous, had to deal with family connection and harmony and history. So in their psychological, should I say, innate deception to program us, they programmed us to think the way they wanted us to think. They wanted our children to leave the land down south, get to the city, only because of the excitement and feel, well, I got a job now to pay $10 a night. I mean, I'm not going back down south and get stuck out in the country where I don't hear or see no people, not realizing that that country is where they can grow their own food and make sure that they can maintain their family without the resources of living in a city. The sad part about it is most of the people who live in the city, when you talk to them and they talk about food, they're talking about going to the grocery store. They're not talking about growing what they could get out of their land and eating what they know they grew. It's a very, very psychological dynamic that comes into play when the value system of the people have been so, should I say, disseminated against, that the people, in most cases, they will take their resources to the other people who literally destroyed the backbone of their growth process in order to manipulate their thought process. And that's why a lot of people today, if you talk to them, you tell them that they don't see any value unless it has a dollar value. Oh, man, what's that worth? How much them shoes cost? You see what I'm saying? Well, how much that car cost? Because they look at it from a negative perspective, where if you look at value based on a tool, and that's really what our parents was doing. They were teaching us. The tool was the land. You could always reuse the tool. But when you take that value system away,
and they don't know how to use the tool, then they gravitate to a value system that's more conducive to the environment they're in. And sadly enough, they don't have the education to even utilize money on a level in which it would be productive for them over a long period of time if they haven't been educated that money is also a tool. I just wanted to add that, and if you brothers give me an opportunity here, I want to give a shameless plug for the Mar Night Show, because literally we're talking about the same thing.
Absolutely.
We're talking about how, okay, but we're talking about how we can bring the personal and cultural value to the, after the psychological destruction that we have been through. Because it's, they're not going to do that for us. That is on our plate. And sadly enough, I was telling some young boys the other night who was on a corner. They were hungry. And some brothers had picked them up and asked, what y'all doing out here? They're 12 years old, talking about they wanted to jack somebody. And I happened to be at the store, the restaurant they were at, when the brother came in. He said, look, man, I got to get these young boys something to eat. And they came in and they were ordering and everything. And he was saying how he seen them on the corner talking about jacking somebody. And we didn't know anything about these guys. So I said, look, man, let me make a contribution to you. And they looked at me all strange. I said, because you're doing what we have to do if we're going to save this generation. We have to let them know that they're not forgotten. We have to let them know that they're valued. And most of all, we have to let them know that they're going to be the leaders of tomorrow. And if that's the case, we're going to have to do something today to make sure that our tomorrow is going to be worthy of the children who live in it. So that's what the Mar Night Show is about, brother. And I appreciate your show, and I'm going to get back in the back room and listen.
Well, thank you, Brother Davis.
Yeah, greatly appreciate your contribution.
Always great to hear from you. Always great to hear from all of the elders. I think one of the biggest things, and Scotty was making mention to it over in the comments, about even though there is a disconnect, there's still no reason for that, for anybody to go and take the family's land. You know, that's just pure greed. That's all it is. He caught sniff of some blood in the water down there.
Yep.
And that's where he headed. You see, he relocated there, but not to live off of the land.
Right.
To purge the people off of the land.
Off of the land.
And like you stated earlier, without enemies within, you won't have to worry about the ones outside if you're getting cut from the back. Scotty, I see you.
I mean, for the people who couldn't see the video, if you look at the video and you see all these elderly people, okay, these are the people that they're talking about to lose their homes and stuff. Cause, and I mean, that's just so disgusting, man, you know, for this dude, this young cat, to come from wherever he came from, you know, using the example of some Indians on Wall Street in New York. That's not even the same thing. Those people were purged off that land by force. And
that's why I use that language.
Yeah, they were purged. So that was totally different than you finding out that you got a small stake or a share in some community property, and then you, along with these enemies of the community, exploit legal loopholes to literally sell the land out from under your elders. What kind of disgusting behavior is that, man? I mean, that's just despicable, man. And I'm trying to stay codified and not say what I think should happen to him. But, man, that's just wrong, man. But, again, though, one of the other key things I heard from that video was these elders not having wills.
Yes.
That's all.
That was something I was thinking about too. I'm glad you pointed it out, because, you know, will is the most important basic way to pass on your belongings that you will not be able to take with you into a mentor. So, you know, that's just basic. You have to do that. And I think sometimes, you know, a lot of us don't like to think of, you know, that particular time. For a lot of people, it's an uncomfortable thing. So they'll put it off and put it off and put it off, and sometimes just forget about it. And, you know, that's where, you know, something happens that's unexpected, and the person passes away, and then, you know, depending on the state, you know, you can lose everything if you don't have a will. You know, I know things can be hectic as far as the way those laws work in New York. I know New Jersey, very, very similar. You know, you can lose everything. So the importance of writing a will when you're, you know, sane and your right mind and great health is essential, just in case. You know, we all hope to live long. You know, I'm at this point lived almost double the life I thought I would live, but now that I have lived this long, I have a lot more work to do. So yeah, I would like to be here for as long as possible, but you never know. So the importance of facilitating that while you're in your right mind and you're able to make those kind of sound decisions is quite important, and it's something that a lot of us neglect, and it's just something that we shouldn't do, because that's just, you know, like Scotty was saying, there's no way that anybody should be losing their land, especially if someone passes away who had that land and they chose not to have a will. I'm thankful, you know, with my in-laws, we had all of that taken care of and made sure everything was finalized as things started to move downhill for them health-wise, so that now things are really, really, you know, smooth outside of the system doing what it does to our people, because we've experienced quite a bit with that, just dealing with power of attorney things and stuff like that. But outside of that, they made it a lot easier for us, because her father and her mother were really sensible about that. So now that she's not, you know, able to remember things, and she's, you know, dealing with dementia and stuff, it's a different, you know, it's different, because it makes it easier for us to be able to do what we need to do to take care of her. So yeah,
it goes back to the question though, the codification, mm-hmm. how we treat, yeah, each other.
Absolutely.
Once people start getting all of this land and they start making these type of moves, what's going to be the generalized rule on how you operate? You know, who are you going to allow to come in there after everything gets established? How are you going to deal with the people who go against those core values that you have established as your code? You know what I'm saying? How are you going to handle them? You know, all of these things need to be discussed. And that's why I was putting that question out there. And the lines, mm-hmm, are still open. If you have a few different rules that you would like to see, maybe that you use around your own home on how you and your family get together, because I know a lot of us, we fight with our family, but then there's certain segments of our family that when we out in public, you know, we might be boiling over, punch you in your nose when we get in the car or when we get to granny house or whatever. But when we out in public, you know, we leave that there, keep things in house. But that's starting to be a trend that's a value that's, it has less weight nowadays. You know, a lot of people will do their own family a lot more dirtier than they would do somebody out on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So that question is still out there.
I just think it just shows the success at the success of the system we live in at deteriorating our families, because that was where the attack was. You know, the first thing they say, if you want to destroy a nation, destroy the family. You know, that's the first thing you have to break apart, you have to fragment. Even when you read King Leopold's letter, it's one of my favorite texts, because it literally is the Willie Lynch letter for real, written by the Belgian king. So it's a documented historical document that basically says everything the Willie Lynch letter says. And he pertains a hefty portion of it to the church and what the church was sent to Africa to do, and their mandate to basically steal land, force the people to pay tithes and offerings, and use those tithes and offerings to build thriving businesses. That's the way he words it in his letter. And, you know, when you see that kind of... And he also says, you know, to make sure you get at the minds of the children. Make it so that the children respect the word of their spiritual father, the priest, more than the words of their own parents. So that right there, they're telling you, go in and transform the way the family is working. Make sure the children have no respect for the parents whatsoever, and that they listen to us, their colonial masters, via, you know, the emblem of Jesus Christ in the Bible. So it's all there, it's laid out. And it's really about the destruction of the family. So when you see these sorts of behaviors, these idiosyncratic self-destructive behaviors, that to the person who's doing these behaviors, it seems normal and everyday, is just really the culture of insanity manifested within that particular individual in the family. And, you know, they just have been so immersed in what the system has offered and so immersed in the way that our colonial masters do things, because, you know, that's something that was always documented, how they'll turn against one another and, you know, the family killing family. Not saying it didn't happen with us either, but I'm just saying, like, that was something we were exposed to. So we embody it. It's just like when I talk about that book, All God's Children, by Fox Butterfield. And it talks about, you know, black people in South Carolina watching white men duel for respect. And then we started emulating what we saw white people doing. And as a result, that has transformed itself into the culture of, you step on my sneakers, I shoot you in the face. You know, you look at my girl, I shoot you in the face. That's where that came from. And Dr. Joy DeGree uses that book to further trace that history. And that's something that she recommended, and it's something I recommend, because it's just a powerful text to give insight into how prisoners of war can be then co-opted culturally by their captors. And then once they take on the culture of their captors then turn around and blame them for the destruction that they're wreaking upon themselves. And there is some onus on the people who are doing the destructive behavior, but ultimately that was something that we have imbibed from them. The worst aspects of ourselves we've really imbibed from being around them for so long. We've taken it in for so long, and we've normalized it, and they psychosocially conditioned us through, you know, entertainment and media and the internet and all the other myriad of things they use to propagandize our psyche, to the point where we think, you know, I think it was Goebbels, who was Hitler's propagandist, who said, you know, the true definition of power is to get someone to do what you want, but make them believe that they thought of it themselves.
So, well, hold on now, hold on.
At controlling their minds, that they think that they're the originator of that thought and idea, when you really put that in their head, and they're not able to discern that you put that in their head. Go ahead.
Now, Roz, mm-hmm. Now, with that being said, I put this article up because we're getting down to the bottom, and we will be continuing this on our regular scheduled show, Real Life, to get through the rest of the things that we wanted to. It kind of just worked out this way. Hope y'all have enjoyed tonight, but we're not done.
That's right.
Let's get into this article real quick, because you just stated that they set these things up to where they cause a problem.
Mm-hmm.
We react, we ask for something, and then they give us what they wanted us to have to begin with.
Absolutely.
And I know you put that up there, so would you like to get into that before we end out tonight?
Absolutely. It's a great little ditty from WakeUpWorld.com about the Hegelian dialectic, and I've talked about that quite a bit, because it's really the base psychology, the base psychological tool, which is actually based on the seven hermetic principles of Tahui, the axiom that deals with polarity, and they use that polarity to keep us under their control, with us thinking we're the ones in control. So here it is. It's called The Politics of Polarity, the Hegelian Dialectic and Its Use in Controlling Modern Society. This is from 2013, but it's so relevant now. What exactly is the Hegelian dialectic? George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel was a 19th century German philosopher who devised a particular method of argument for resolving disagreements. His method of arriving at, quote, the truth, unquote, by exchanging logical arguments is a system of thought process still used to this day. To put it simply, the basis of Hegelianism assumes that the human mind can't understand anything unless it can be split into two polar opposites, good and evil, right, wrong, right and left, thesis, antithesis. For example, when people are talking about two political parties, what they're actually referring to without realizing it is the thesis and antithesis based on the Hegelian dialectic. The only real debate that occurs on any subject relates to the minor differences between the two parties. Nothing is said or done about the issues that neither left nor right is discussing. In polarity politics, they control the agenda. In Australia, this in particular will become more apparent as the elections draw near, creating a problem to solve. Another form of the Hegelian dialectic is problem-reaction-solution. Most of us unwittingly fall victim to it all too often, and sadly, if we don't stop, we will continue to lose our free will and liberty. It has been widely used by our governments and corporations around the world. You can say that in terms of controlling the masses and society in general, its deployment has been an effective tool in keeping humanity in check. Almost all major events in history employed the Hegelian dialectic of problem, manufacture a crisis, or take advantage of one already in place in order to get the desired reaction, which is the second one, of the public, of public outcry, whereby the public demands a solution which is has been predetermined from the very beginning. A classic example is 9/11. Only when you break the left-right paradigm and come to the realization that the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan and the whole fake, and not to mention contradictory war on terror, was always the desired outcome for neoconservatives in the Bush administration and the military-industrial complex. They even stated in their own white papers the need for another catastrophic and catalyzing event to solve, like a new Pearl Harbor, quote-unquote. To their benefit, they got one. Here's one more current example of the Hegelian dialectic in use. In Australia at present, the article published in 2013, both of the main political parties on the eve of the upcoming election on September 7th are discussing, quote, vote people, unquote, a derogatory term used to describe refugees and asylum seekers displaced by war or other hardships. I don't believe that they constitute what you would call a, quote, unquote, crisis, and, excuse me, I don't believe that they constitute what you would call a quote-unquote crisis, and the statistics clearly show they aren't, but our quote-unquote government is telling us they are a problem. Again, the media is used to play up this problem in order to instigate a reaction, meaning a debate in the public domain on how to tackle the problem, quote-unquote. Both the opposition and ruling party offered their solution, and the result, the introduction of hardline, quote-unquote, border protection policies at the expense of refugees' human rights. Again, we see that the only real debate occurring is just the minor differences between those two parties. Nothing is said or done about the many other more important issues that neither left or right is discussing. Seeing through theatrics, in order to avoid falling victim to the Hegelian dialectic from now on, you must remember the process involved. Anytime a major problem or issue arises in society, think about who will gain or profit from it. Then remove yourself from the equation, take a step back and look at it from a third-party perspective. See the so-called problem, look at who's reacting, why, and in what way. Then look for who is offering up the solution. When you do this, you'll quickly see the real truth instead of the false truth they wanted you to see. And that is the end of the article. And I think it's just important to always keep the Hegelian dialectic at the forefront of your mind, because it is probably the most powerful tool of controlling massive amounts of human beings ever developed. And it's something that they use as ad infinitum because it works. Like they say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. There's no reason to try anything else because the same thing works over and over. Because like I've always said, we function in a culture of insanity, and they know it. They know that we're used to doing the same things over and over, seeking a solution that we'll never get. So we're basically crazy. We're all functioning crazy, at least the majority of us, in a way in which we never make headway, because the people who do think outside of the proverbial box always get drowned out by the masses of people who are going, you know, in the direction of the Hegelian dialectic. Really, really.
It's crazy. But I wanted to get that in real quick before we got up out of here. And for those of you who don't know who the Gullah Geechee is, They were some black Africans, like they stated in the beginning. But that's the 100-year war that you hear about, the Gullah Wars. But with that being said, Brother Rise, we're down at the end. You want to let them know where they can find us? We'll be right back on Real Life the Radio Show at 9 o'clock. Yeah. At 9 o'clock p.m. same place, same number. Y'all come check us out. If this the first time y'all hearing us, hope it was constructive for you. You got some good information, and we look to see you again. Brother Rise, you gonna say the prayer and take us out of here?
Yes. Thanks for spending your Tuesday evening with us. Thanks to Brother Dave for giving us the platform. You know, short notice, we're able to make it happen. I'm happy about that. thanks to you, Scotty, as well, you know, for doing what you do and being who you are. And, you know, I love and appreciate you. Thanks for all the callers and listeners, Brother Rio, Brother Davis, all the other callers and listeners as well. And I'll just say the prayer now and take us out of here. Creator, we ask that you help us to remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us to remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times and all places, each and every time that we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice ASAP. I am in the love of the all, and all love is in me. I am a part of the all, and the all is a part of me. I am one with the all, and the all is one with me. I can succeed as a part of the all and fail as an individual. I can be all that I wish in the all, as long as my wish is to stay in the all. I am never alone. The all is, I am. The all can, I can. The all does, I do. Peace and love. Thanks again for spending your evening with us. We'll see you again at 9 p.m. Thanks again, Scotty.
Peace and love. Peace and love.
Gold dinar would have had serious consequences for the world financial system, but may also have empowered the people of Africa, something black activists say the U.S. wants to avoid at all costs.
We're slicing cake. We're slicing cake.